Podcast, Tuesday, July 24th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it's been another one of those crazy weeks. I don't know. I'm probably getting to that age, that time in life when you just never have enough time for everything. Just there's so much to do. You probably like me. And have those kinds of issues, or maybe you don't. Maybe you're really lucky and you've got extra time on your hands. But it always seems like there's something coming up between work and the programming and all the social things that you try and stay on top of. Just you get to the end of the day and you're like, wow, I'm recording this podcast really late. But I guess that's never changed. We've been doing this for how many years together? And it's pretty much how this goes. So anyway, I'm kind of excited. We've got a lot of great stuff to talk about. We're going to get a little technical on this episode, actually, with some of your feedback. I got a really interesting question and dilemma, and I had to kind of dive deep on. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And, we're on Mountain Lion Eve. Can we call it that? Mountain Lion is going to be here probably by the time you hear this, actually. You'll probably have it in your hot little hands, be downloading it from the App Store. But we got that to cover. Apple's quarterly earnings call happened today, and lots of other great stuff to get into. But before we dive into all of that, let's take a quick moment and thank one of our show's sponsors, and that's Smile. I want to talk to you today about Text Expander 4. Did you know Text Expander 4 was out? I don't know if you've upgraded or not. If you haven't upgraded, you need to upgrade. Lots of great stuff in there. If you haven't tried out Text Expander, now is a great time to check it out because they have this new version out. And one of the coolest things is that they expanded the fill-in, the blank snippet functionality. Now, if you don't know what this is, you know, Text Expander, you can type a little snippet, just a couple little characters of code, and Text Expander will be there in the background running, and it can expand out an entire portion, a whole essay, really, if you want, of text based on a little shortcut, just a couple of keys that you type in. And so this is particularly great for saving time if you have to find yourself typing the same thing over and over again. So, you know, customer support is a great example of this. So I have to do a lot of that. I answer a lot of emails. I answer a lot of your emails. And oftentimes I'll have the same questions. So I can, when I see that happening, if I get the same question two or three times in a row, I can kind of write out a response, but then use Text Expander to customize it because you can now use these fill-in-the-blank snippets. So you can customize simple things like adding in somebody's name, and that functionality has been there for a while. But what they've expanded in 4 is they've now given you the ability to have other types of fill-ins. So not just a blank text field, but you can have multi-line text fields. You can have pop-up menus that have multiple choices. You can have optional text blocks that, you know, if you need to deviate, it's almost like, I think of it almost like choose your own adventure snippets, because you can have all of these little sections that you can choose at expansion time whether you're going to add those in or not. You just hit a checkbox and it'll add that additional block of text, or if you leave it unchecked, then it won't put it in there. And so it's just a really powerful, amazing tool, and there's a bunch of other features in there. There's, if you're a new user, if you haven't tried it out yet, there's now a new snippet creation assistant that's going to give you a step-by-step walkthrough on how to get started with this stuff. So they make it really quick and easy. And they've got great pricing on it. Text Expander starts at $34.95 for a single license. A family pack is just $44.95. And if you want to get it for the office, they have office packs, 5 license office packs for $99.95. And if you haven't upgraded, if you're already a Text Expander 3 user, you can upgrade for just $15. And if you purchase Text Expander after January 15th, you can get a free upgrade. So that's awesome. And they always have great customer service and support. They have free trials available on their website. So if you want to try before you buy, you can do that. But you're going to love it. So just go get it now. SmileSoftware.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So Tim Cook and his crew took the stage, or I guess the telephone, really. They do a conference call and had their third quarter earnings call for 2012, Apple came in slightly under Wall Street analyst predictions. So they had a little bit lower profits than everybody was expecting, a little bit lower numbers than were expected. But you know what? They were still amazing. They still did really, really well. As a matter of fact, revenues were up 22.4%. They had total revenues of $35 billion and a net profit of $8.8 billion. Apple said that they were underperforming numbers mainly for two key reasons. They said declining sales due to rumors and speculation of new products. Now, they didn't kind of specifically call it out, but really what they were alluding to was the impending, or what we believe to be is the impending iPhone launch. So you all are holding off on making your iPhone purchases, and Apple said that's why sales were down a little bit. The other thing that they cited was just the declining economy, which was interesting because Apple hasn't done that yet. You know, a lot of companies are citing the economy as sort of the reason for why they're having less profits and doing less well. And Apple hadn't done that yet. They did that in this conference call, but mainly they were talking about Europe sales declining. Europe had been doing really, really well over the past couple quarters, and it sounds like those numbers are down a little bit. And it was down across the board. The U.S. and other countries didn't do quite as well, but the declines weren't as big in the U.S. and Asia Pacific, at least according to what Apple was saying on the call. So we still did okay in those markets. And overall, as you can tell, Apple's making money, their profits are up, and they're still gaining momentum. As a matter of fact, when they dove into the details, Mac sales were up overall, but just about 2% from a year ago. So that's quite a bit lower than we've seen, I think, in some of the past quarters. But overall, Apple's doing better than the PC market in general, which has been seeing steady declines in sales over the past few quarters. Even though Apple said folks that are holding out on buying those new iPhones, they did manage to sell an amazing number of units, 26 million iPhones sold in the quarter, and that's a 28% increase from the same period last year. The iPad, though, that was not surprisingly the big winner for Apple again this quarter. Apple added $9.2 billion in revenue on iPads and sold 17 million units in the quarter. That was up from 9.2 million units sold last year. iPod sales continued to decline. That was no big surprise, but Apple did manage to sell a respectable 6.8 million units, and that's down just 10%, which I think, I'm trying to get my memory serving me right, but I think that's slightly less of a decline than we've seen in past quarters. So iPods are doing okay. One of the big surprises was Apple TV. They didn't really talk about those numbers, but it came up in the Q&A, and the Apple TV sold 1.3 million units in the quarter, up 170% from the same period a year ago. So if you just look at percentage growth, the Apple TV, Apple's little hobby product, is doing quite well. So far this year, Apple sold a total of 4 million Apple TV units. So, you know, that could become something. And Tim Cook kind of alluded to that in the call, said, you know, it's a hobby, but we didn't set out to do a hobby just for no reason. We do expect eventually something to come of it. And it sounds like it might be moving in that direction. But he did reconfirm that it is just, quote unquote, a hobby for Apple. I'll call it a very lucrative one, though. A couple other interesting things from the call. They were asked about Passbook specifically. That's the new sort of card functionality that's in iOS 6 coming out probably along with those new phones in the fall. And they were asked, is that a precursor to Apple doing their own mobile payment system? Tim Cook reiterated and said, you know, the focus right now is on replacing things like tickets, movie tickets, and tickets to sporting events, loyalty cards, coupons, that sort of thing. And, you know, I get that. He seemed to kind of avoid the question a little bit. But as far as Apple doing any sort of near field communication payment system, or, you know, pay with your phone, tap to pay kind of system, you know, I know those rumors are really strong, but I have to wonder, you know, it seems like Apple has a great payment system already in your iTunes account. You know, all of us have iTunes accounts. They're tied to our credit cards. Apple's very often in their keynotes and in these conference calls iterated how many credit cards they have on file so that people can quickly and easily make purchases for Apple stuff. And in the past, that was always through, you know, the stores, through so buying apps and buying iTunes music and movies and iBooks and things like that. But this year, Apple kind of expanded that model into their brick-and-mortar stores. So you can go in now to an Apple store and through their app, just scan the barcode with your iPhone and make your purchase directly through your iTunes account. So to me, it seems like it works so well in their retail stores. Why wouldn't they just sort of extend that and expand it outside their walls? They didn't talk about that in the conference call. That's just kind of something that I was thinking of as this question was coming up. You know, is Apple going to do some sort of mobile payment system? And it seems to me like they've already got a lot of the pieces in place, and Passbook is just another one of those things that adds on top of that. And that's sort of what I got from what Tim, from the remarks that Tim Cook was making. The other thing that came out of the call was that Apple is doing incredibly well in the education market. They've had their best growth ever in the education market, but it's mostly on the back of iPads. Macs are doing well, but in the EDU market, it seems to be the first place where we're seeing this shift. Tim Cook's talked about the fact that he expects tablet devices to overtake PCs in the future, this post-PC shift. Looks like that's happening for Apple in the education market, because Apple said iPads outsold Macs 2-to-1 in the education market. And they also commented that iTunes U has been a big hit. It's had over 14 million downloads, so they're doing very well in the education sector. And then I guess they kind of buried the lead a little bit, because in the press release, and I don't know if this came out in the conference call, I haven't had a chance to look through the entire transcripts, but they did announce that Mountain Lion is arriving on the 25th, July 25th, which is, as I'm recording this, tomorrow, but probably is going to be today or maybe a couple days ago for you, but they did let that slip, and they normally don't do that sort of thing. It just sort of quietly comes out, but that was the quarterly results. So underperforming the analysts, but still doing very, very well, especially when you take into account the industry as a whole. And so I guess we probably should talk about Mountain Lion. I will be scrambling to get you the details on how to install, how to upgrade, what the new features are, why you need it, why you maybe don't need it, and getting a little FaceTime with the application. So expect that on upcoming episodes of the MacCast. But just a couple quick tips and thoughts and things like that, though, I thought I should share. If you are planning on upgrading right away when it comes out, expect that on launch day, Apple servers might be having some issues. You might have download problems. It might take a little longer to get it because you do have to download it. But when you're going to be ready to install, or if you want to get ready now, you probably want to do a couple things. One, backup. I've talked about that. You should always have your backups. And actually, I'm going to be ready to go because, you know, I have my nightly backups, and I'm sure you probably do as well. But for those of you who don't, make sure that you back up. And if you plan to erase an install and do, you know, quote unquote, a clean install of Mountain Lion, remember that if you only have one backup, the minute that you erase your internal drive, you now have no backups. People often forget that, because if something goes wrong in the middle of that install, and then you go to your backup drive and suddenly discover, oh, there's a problem there as well, you could potentially lose data. So don't fall into that trap. That's my number one thing. So have two backups if you're going to do an erase install. If you're going to just do an over-the-top install, you probably still want backups, two backups, but you might be able to get away with just one. Check your disk. So before you download and install Mountain Lion, you might want to run some utilities, run disk utility, run repair permissions, make sure everything is okay with your internal hard drive, especially if you have an older machine. Just make sure that it's ready to go and working at its best. And somewhat related to that, I would guess, is have a bailout plan. You know, you might consider installing Mountain Lion on a second Mac, especially if you rely on your Mac to get work done. You probably don't want to be installing on day one. Wait for the community, the rest of us, to kind of try it out, test it out for you. Don't be the guinea pig, especially on your work production system. But if you are going to do that, make sure you have a backup plan for recovery, so you're not going to lose a ton of time should something go completely wrong or you find a piece of software that's incompatible. So something you might consider is keeping around a cloned backup of your old system, a bootable clone, so that if you run into trouble, you can just dock that in USB or FireWire and boot up from it and get back to work, and then come back to the mountain lion issues when you have more time. I guess also preparing to do the upgrade, you probably want to clear out the cruft. This is what I say, where you go through and kind of take inventory of everything that's on your system, all that old software that you installed that you never ever used. You thought you might, but you didn't end up using that application. You might want to clear that stuff out, clean off the hard drive, find those old files and documents that are taking up space on your hard drive. And maybe now is the time to archive that stuff, get it off, put it on another volume, put it up in the cloud, put it someplace else, get it off that main drive, and just make room, make a little space for your new operating system. And then before getting ready to install, make sure that you check all of the applications that you use, especially the critical ones that you use on a daily basis. Make sure those are ready to run on Mountain Lion. And don't forget about some of the smaller things like drivers, menu bar items. So if you have a peripheral, something that you're dependent upon, like a printer or a scanner, make sure that that's going to work. Don't forget about preference panes, little preference applications you may have installed, or plugins inside other applications. A lot of people forget about those. So they find out, you know, the core application that I use, Photoshop or Aperture, Lightroom, whatever it might be, that works, but you have that one plugin that you really depend upon and it's incompatible. So you want to make sure all that stuff is up to date. Great website for doing that. And I noticed that they are updating and getting ready for Mountain Lion, roaringapps.com. You can go there. They have a huge database of almost every application that runs on Mac OS X, and they'll tell you if it's ready to go or not. And then, you know, overall, just check your specs. Make sure that your Mac can run Mountain Lion, because not every Mac can. Apple has a list on the website of the machines that are supported. In general, what you're going to need is a 2008 or newer Mac that has a discrete graphics processor. So if you have the Intel integrated graphics, you may not be able to run Mountain Lion, even if you have a little bit older Mac. So just be aware of that, and you can check on that stuff. We don't know right now. It is going to be download only through the Mac App Store. I don't know if Apple's Recovery Disk Assistant tool is going to be updated to allow you to create a little USB, you know, boot drive so that you can install directly from kind of hardware. And it hasn't been put out that Apple's actually going to sell the little USB stick like they did with Lion, sounding like that they're not going to do that. So you are probably going to, if you want to be able to have a boot volume, you're going to have to create your own. Luckily, it sounds like the old steps of manually creating a disk from the install esd.dmg file that's inside the package installer that you download from Apple, sounds like that procedure still works. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. Pretty easy. You can use a USB thumb drive. You just have to kind of dig in there. And you have to do it before you run the installer. So if you download from the Mac App Store, it's going to automatically try and run the installer. You're going to want to quit out of that first and then get back in to get at the files that you need to build that boot disk. So just remember that. And the other thing that I read was that Mountain Lion reportedly will not install on systems that don't meet the specifications. So, you probably can buy it on one system, but if you try and take it to another system that's not supported, it's probably not going to run the installer at all. I would expect, though, at some point we're going to see some hacks to kind of make it install onto older machines, get around some of the restrictions or limitations that Apple put in place. Who knows how that's going to perform? That's the kind of stuff that I'm going to be digging into and hopefully covering on future episodes. The one thing that I read, I think, over on Macworld, though, too, that's not clear is what happens if you have an older Mac, specifically, say, something like a Mac Pro, that the processor and all the other stuff is up to snuff, but maybe it's not installing because of the graphics. You go out and you add an upgraded graphics card, or are you going to be able to upgrade to Mountain Lion? And no one knows at this point, so we'll have to just find out about that later. So I already mentioned you get it exclusively through the Mac App Store. Pricing on it is going to be $19.99 US. So I have a feeling a lot of people are going to upgrade if you have a compatible machine. They've made it very affordable. It's almost hard not to upgrade. But I will say, if you're using your Mac for critical operations on a day-to-day basis, you don't need to upgrade on day one. There's some nice new features in there, but I can't point to any one feature that I can say that's the critical thing. That's what you need to absolutely upgrade for. So hold off a little bit, just general good advice. Make sure everything's stable and running. Make sure all your applications and software will work with it, and then do your upgrade. But I'm going to be putting it on a MacBook Air, a secondary machine that I have to play around and test out with and get the coverage for the MacCast. So that's how I'm going to be upgrading, at least at first. And we'll get into the details on how to do a clean install and all that other stuff on probably the next episode. So stay tuned for that. I know we've been talking about some of the rumors that are going on about new hardware. Specifically, the big one that we've discussed quite a bit is the iPad mini, the 7.85 inch iPad that is expected to be coming out in the fall. Also, we know about the iPhone 5. We've been talking about that for such a long time. But it looks like the iPod Touch is saying, hey, I don't want to be left out of that party you guys are all having in the fall. And we may get a new iPod Touch making its appearance alongside the iPhone 5 and the iPad mini. The device reportedly would share the same screen as the redesigned iPhone. So we're looking at approximately a 4-inch screen measured diagonally, 3.99 inches to be exact, I think is the number that's being thrown around. And the big deal behind this new screen is that it will use the in-cell technology, meaning that they're going to merge the capacitive touch layer and the display together into a single unit, letting it get a little bit thinner. But because they're using a brand new technology, and that technology, I guess, doesn't have as high a yield, at least from the rumors that I've been reading, we can expect that with the high demand of the iPhone 5, adding in using the same screen and a new iPod Touch, that they're going to be very short on supply. And so we can expect constrained supplies and delays, especially if Apple continues the aggressive international rollouts that they've been doing. And I have no reason to believe they wouldn't. I would expect, actually, they're going to roll out launch day with the iPhone 5 in even more countries than they ever have before. But getting back to some of the specifications on the touch, beyond the screen, it looks like the new device will also use an A5 processor, just like the iPhone 4S and the iPad 2. And the back, in terms of how it looks, the casing, or the back case rather, is going to be a buffed aluminum case. So to me, it sounds very similar to the back case of the new iPad. And I would expect it to kind of feel and look very similar, black and white in terms of the colors, just like they have been in the past. And again, that's expected to be launched alongside the new iPhone sometime in the fall. And it sounds like Apple is gearing up for that new iPhone launch so that they will have a good supply when we're ready to buy those things. A report came out and said that they are entering production at the Pegatron plant. I still think that's the best name for a company making iPhones. Pegatron, it sounds like every time... Of course, you just think of Transformers, right? But they are entering into production, and it's still believed that the new iPhone is going to have a smaller 19-pin dock connector. So this will be the first time Apple has deviated from that 30-pin dock connector on the iPhone. iMore says that there will be some sort of adapter to make it so you can use your 30-pin, I'm assuming cables and hopefully accessories and stuff like that. They didn't give a lot of details on how that adapter specifically would work. They also didn't know if the adapter was going to be included in the box with the iPhone 5 or if it was going to be sold as an accessory. And I have to apologize. I keep saying iPhone 5 just to give it kind of a name to call it, to distinguish it from the current iPhones. But I would expect Apple is also going to continue the trend that it has been doing, with its new products, and that the iPhone is just going to be called the new iPhone, just like we saw with the new iPad. And they're going to get rid of the numeric moniker on the end of the product name. So the new iPhone will be coming out in the fall, and we'll have that new dock connector. And then finally, we're also getting some early rumors of a couple other products coming out in the fall timeframe. A 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro. I know that one's been floating around for a little while. We hadn't really heard a date on that one, so some news reports came out this week expecting that that will come out in the fall, maybe around the September timeframe. Seems like that would just be a little bit too late for any kind of back-to-school sales. So maybe they're hoping to capture a little bit of the holiday market with a lower-end or a smaller MacBook Pro. I shouldn't say lower-end, smaller Retina MacBook Pro. And then there's also some rumors that we might see some new iMacs toward the end of the year, sometime around October, new iMacs. And I know some people have thrown out that there would be Retina iMacs. I think this next generation of iMacs are probably not going to be Retina, just because of the size of the display and just the sheer, you know, manufacturing problems that that might impose. And probably just pricing in terms of the cost of the panels. I think it's cost prohibitive at this point. I can see them going with smaller displays like the 13-inch, but bumping it up to a 24-inch or a 27-inch display. I think it's just not going to happen this year. Maybe sometime next year, but bumped up processors and things like that. I think it'll be a small rev to the iMacs. And again, probably trying to capture some of the holiday sales as we move toward the end of the year. And Apple just wants to make sure that their numbers are up and they're kind of keeping that trend where they don't have a lot of dips in sales and keep those numbers up and keep the growth going. And one way you can certainly do that is by putting out new models and revving your models on a consistent basis. So sounds like we got a lot to look forward to in the fall, and I'm sure over the next few months we're going to be getting a lot more details about what we can expect to see in terms of specifics, and of course we'll be covering those on upcoming episodes. And then finally, it sounds like Apple may have slipped out a very small tweak to their Thunderbolt displays, and it's actually not even technically a hardware tweak, I don't think. This came in according to 9to5Mac. They reported noticing a change in the part code on the Thunderbolt display. They changed it from MC914LL/A to MC914LL/B. And there's only speculation at this point as to what changed. There seems to be no specifications or anything within the monitor itself, but the general feeling is that Apple may be including a MagSafe to MagSafe 2 adapter actually in the box when you purchase the display. I guess at the Apple retail store, if you went in since June and purchased the new display, what they were doing is just grabbing off the shelf and throwing in with your purchase a MagSafe to MagSafe 2 adapter. And the reason for that is that the new MacBooks and MacBook Airs that just came out need to have that adapter in order to be compatible with the display. So by putting it in the box, I would imagine that it's more consistent, making sure that everybody gets one of those adapters along with their display. Again, that hasn't been confirmed. So if you have purchased a new Thunderbolt display and it has this new part code on it, let us know if you noticed anything different in the box. I'd be curious to find out and get confirmation on that one. And with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. I want to follow up a little bit on the conversation that I brought up on the last episode. I did a little bit of commentary, just some thoughts. Somebody had prompted me and asked me about, you know, this idea that Macs are becoming less and less upgradable. So the trigger for all this, of course, is the Retina MacBook Pro, which has a battery that is sealed. Nothing new in Mac laptops, but in this case, it's not just sealed, but it's also physically glued down to the back case, so it makes replacing it a little bit more difficult. You have RAM that is soldered on the motherboard, so whatever you buy is what you have, and you can't just go in after the fact and upgrade, add more by sticking some RAM chips in a slot. You're locked into what you have. You have the flash storage. I always want to say SSD, but Apple calls it flash storage. that is built into the device. That's on a card, but it has kind of a proprietary connector. It's an odd shape, so it's, you can't just go buy an off-the-shelf SSD drive, you know, 2.5-inch SSD drive, and pop it in there. There already are some third-party aftermarket cards. OWC is selling them already, so you will be able to upgrade that, but it, again, gets a little bit trickier. So the conversation was centered around this whole idea of, are these devices that are becoming, quote-unquote, less upgradable, does that make them any more or less a pro computer? Like, how much does it matter to a pro user that you are able to sort of upgrade the internals of your system? And I have to tell you, this prompted a lot of conversation from you. I got a lot of emails. I got a lot of feedback. I got comments like this one from Jason.
Hello, Adam. Just wanted to give my brief comments on the new MacBook Pro. And you were asking to get some feedback on what we thought of them as a pro computer. I think for the most part, 90% of the people, pro users, are going to be fine with 8 or 16 gigabytes of RAM for the next 5 years at least. If we go back 5 years in the past and had 4 gigabytes of RAM in our machines, 4 years ago, that's still plenty for most users to do pretty much everything. Now, the pro user, 8 and 16, I feel like that's going to be fine in 5 years. And by then, you're going to be ready for the next machine anyway. The display, the way it's made, is, I don't see that much of a difference on the way it is made now. The ones on previous generation unibody MacBooks had sealed displays. You couldn't get to the screens. And this one looks to me to be exactly the same thing. I don't know what the fuss is about. As far as RAM soldered onto the board, well, if I would get AppleCare, which I would suggest anyway, because then you're covered for 3 years. Anything happens, Apple's going to fix it for you. So just wanted to give my little comment on that. Also, the hard drive. Forgot to mention that. I think that in the future months, that third-party companies will come out with some kind of adapter that you could put a hard drive in, or somebody's going to make replacement hard drives with the shape that the ones that are in the new MacBook Pro. All right, just wanted to leave my comments. Keep up the good work, Adam. Thanks for the great show. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Jason. And yeah, I already mentioned that OWC does have those hard drives, so that part of it's already happened. And I think you make some good points there. And there were a lot of listeners who agreed with Jason. A point that was brought up that I found interesting was that pro users are probably more likely to replace their machines more frequently, so aftermarket upgrades may factor in a little bit less. Putting components closer to the metal, soldering things onto the motherboard, allows the system not only to be smaller, but can potentially also increase performance. And that is something that pro users also very much want. So by building in sort of all of the pro specifications, the argument kind of went that, you don't need to necessarily upgrade it because it has everything that you need in it. It'll do everything you want. And I think that's a little bit what Jason was alluding to by saying, 16 gigs of RAM, for a lot of people, that is going to be plenty, at least for a while. And if you're replacing your machine every 2 to 3 years, well, you're going to get the new machine that's going to have 32 gigs soldered on there. So do you really need to add in another stick? You just buy it up front. And it used to be that Apple had the price premium on RAM, but they're really not doing that anymore. So they're pretty price competitive on that. So you can't kind of make that argument. Being a pro computer for a lot of you seemed to be more about having a system that performs the task at hand and does it with performance and reliability. The argument went from a lot of you that individual specifications were becoming less and less of an issue as long as the performance was there when you needed it. And I absolutely get this, but I also know that there's going to be those edge cases where if you could just add a third-party card for graphics or a bigger hard drive or more RAM, it might solve some issues. And that, for a lot of people, is what makes a pro system. And we had that side of the conversation happen, too. There were many pro users who felt that Apple is leaving the quote-unquote pro market behind by not including what they consider to be really pro features. You've got Thunderbolt in there, and it's really great that that's on board, but as many people pointed out, adoption by third parties has been very, very slow moving. And, you know, this was something that we experienced also with USB and FireWire when they were introduced. It did take a long time for that adoption curve to get up before that kind of expansion and that kind of speed was really usable. And so that being slow has caused a little bit of a problem for some pro consumers out there who want the latest, greatest, fastest performing stuff, and they literally can't get their hands on it. Many feel that Apple is giving some signs saying that, you know, we really are not in this pro market. We're more about the consumer, maybe the prosumer. And they point to things like Apple cutting their server line, getting rid of Xserves and those products, refocusing Final Cut and putting more iMovie-like features in there. I'm still a little bit on the fence about Final Cut because I've talked to people on both sides of that argument as well. Some people absolutely hate it and say it's not a pro product. And then I have other pro users who I talk to who say, you know, it's just a rethinking and a retooling, and it really is a pro product. So that goes back and forth. And now you have what some consider to be the quote-unquote closed MacBook Pro line that you can't get in there and upgrade and swap out components. And they're saying all these things point to signs saying that Apple's really not interested in that high-end pro market anymore. Another one that was pointed out that I think gets overlooked a lot and might be a bigger deal than some of these other things like a sealed battery is someone said, you know, what I really am bothered by is the loss of the Ethernet port. You know, that is a pro feature. We want to have these things hooked up on the fastest possible networks and we have to get the little dongle adapter. Why isn't that little critical port just built in? And that's often not mentioned, but it is a big deal to some pro consumers. You know, and to many, not having the ability to update or upgrade those components builds in an expiration date on the computer. So I found this conversation interesting because it is in direct opposite to the argument that, well, it is a pro system because we're going to upgrade our pro systems every 2 or 3 years. I had other pro users saying, you know, I need to keep my machine for 5 or 6 years, and the ability to put in a new graphics card or a more updated hard drive with more storage is what makes it a pro system for me. So it was complete opposite of that opinion. And it was a great conversation. I want to thank everyone who kind of chimed in on that. And you're not too late. If you want to get in on this conversation, send me an email, send me an audio comment, or go on the MacCast forums and start up a conversation over there. But related to this whole conversation, I thought, you know, for those of us who have machines now and want to be able to upgrade them, I'd sort of cover some of the things I do and some of the components I typically upgrade. I mentioned that I very often will do memory upgrades or hard drive upgrades, but I didn't talk about sort of how you do that, the process that I go through, and how I pick different components and where I go and stuff like that. So the number one thing that you need to do if you're going to try and upgrade your Mac, and again, I'm just going to cover memory and hard drive. We can get into other things in future episodes if you'd like, is you need to figure out what you have. So the first thing to do is figure out your specs, what model you have, and you can do that by going into your system profiler. If you go under the Apple menu and you choose about this Mac, you can get into it that way. You typically want to click the little more info button to drill in deeper, or if you'd rather just get to the system profiler directly, if you hold down the option key while you click on the Apple menu, you'll notice the about this Mac changes straight to the system information, and you can click on that, and that'll bring up the dialog, and you can dig through that. The other great resource, and I've mentioned this on the MacCast in the past, but I'll mention it again, is Mac Tracker. Great piece of donationware. If you use it, I strongly encourage you to pay the developer, because I don't want this program to ever go away. But they have the system specifications for every Apple product ever made, and in a lot of detail. You can go into the tab and see specifically what kind of memory you need and what kind of memory your system will take and how much memory it can handle. Specs about the model numbers. You know, if you're having a hard time figuring out, am I Mac Pro 3,1 or 5,7 or 82,57, that's all in there. And I know that last one is a totally made up number. Just for the record, don't email me. But you go in, figure out what your specs are, and then you're going to, you know, figure out what kind of components you need. So hard drives, basically you have two choices these days. You've got SSD and you've got what people call spindle drives or spinning drives. Spinning drives are going to offer you more storage for the price. And in terms of performance, you're going to want to look at the rotational speed, whether it's 5400 RPM or 7200 RPM. Faster is generally better, but it can generate more heat. So something to think about if you're going to be putting a 7200 RPM drive in a Mac that had a cooling system built for a 5400 RPM drive, you can do it. But you may run into heat issues. So very often people ask me, can I put a 7200 RPM drive in my Mac? And the flat answer is it's usually not a technical problem. It usually might end up being some sort of heat problem. So you might notice your fans kicking on more, and that bothers some people. So you may want to consider sticking with a 5400 RPM drive. Of course, these days, a lot of people are moving to SSDs. It's an incredible upgrade. You're going to pay a lot more for per gigabyte in terms of storage. The prices are coming down, but performance will be through the roof. And you can read some of the SSD reviews and do a little bit of research on firmware and compatibility with your Mac. Make sure that your Mac can support it, because not all of the Macs can. And not all drives work in the Macs. So you need to check and make sure you get a brand and a manufacturer that supports the Mac. Check on their website. Some of them will actually have firmware updates to be compatible. Hard drive sizes, you basically have 3.5-inch or 2.5-inch drives, and the general rule is a 3.5-inch disk is going to be for a desktop, 2.5-inch is for a notebook. Different interfaces, pretty much these days it's standardized on a SATA interface, and it'll just be the difference of whether it's SATA 2 or SATA 3 in most cases. IDE, still around out there, but that's pretty old Mac. If you've got an IDE drive, it's a different style interface. You just need to make sure. And again, check Mac Tracker. It'll tell you what kind of interface you have. But let's talk about SATA, which is going to be the most common. Basically, it comes in three different speed flavors, 1.5, 3, or 6 gigabits per second. 1.5 is the oldest spec. Generally, as I said, you're going to find that you're going to either have a SATA 2 drive, which is the 3 gigabits per second, or a SATA 3 drive, which is 6 gigabits per second. And SATA should be backwards compatible, meaning that if you have a machine that's SATA 2, it's rated at 3 gigabits per second, you can still buy a SATA 3 drive. The difference is that you're going to be limited in terms of the speed by the maximum that you can support. So you're only ever going to get 3 gigabits, even if you put a 6 gigabit drive in there. And that's just a chipset physical limitation that you're not going to get around. But you don't have to worry about, you know, buying a faster rated drive and putting it in a slower rated machine. It should just work. So again, figuring out what you have, go into the Apple menu, go into the system profiler, and then from there, you're going to want to select the serial ATA entry from the left-hand column, and then up in the top pane in the main interface on the right, you should see the SATA interfaces that you have available to your Mac. You can select one of those, and then you'll get the details on it in the little bottom pane down at the bottom. And if you want to know what kind of speed your SATA interface is, there'll be an entry down there called link speed, and that'll say 3 gigabits per second or 6 gigabits per second, and then you'll know. So that's kind of how you can figure out hard drives and hard drive upgrades. Memory, The big question most people usually ask is, how much memory can my Mac take? Again, Mac Tracker is a great application for this because, interestingly, some Macs will officially support one spec or one maximum and then actually be able to have more RAM than Apple originally spec'd out. And the reason for this is Apple usually rates it based on the biggest size memory module that you can get at the time. So maybe when the Mac came out, you could only get 2 gigabyte modules, but now you can get 4 gigabyte modules. And so if you have two slots, maybe originally maxed out at 4 gigabytes, but if you can put 4 gigabyte sticks in there, now you can max out at 8 gigabytes. There are also some models of Macs that have a physical limitation based on the motherboard. So you might have two slots and Apple says it maxes out at 4. You can now put those 4 gigabyte modules in there, but the motherboard locks it down to only recognizing, say, 6 gigabytes of that RAM. And so while you'll have, you know, 8 gigabytes in there, you're not going to be able to take advantage of use all of it, but you can still upgrade beyond the 4 gigabytes that Apple says that you're limited at. So the thing you know need to know about memory is you need to figure out, what type do I have or what kind do I have? And a great way to do this is Crucial.com, which is a place that I really like to buy my memory at. They have this great little memory selector tool, and you can put in the model of Mac that you have. Again, just get it through looking at Mac Tracker, find all the details, and they'll tell you exactly what kind of RAM your Mac will take based on the module or based on the model. But basically, there's two kinds you're going to come across these days, DDR2 and DDR3. You can also figure out what you have through the System Profiler. Again, go to the Apple menu, go to System Information, and then in the column on the left-hand side, you're going to select Memory. And then up in the top pane, you should see, one, how many slots you have, and the memory that you have currently installed. And it'll show under the type column whether it's DDR2 or DDR3. It'll show the size of the module, and it will also show the speed. And then if you select a specific slot in there, you can get actually more details down in the little panel below. So the other factor beyond, you know, do I need DDR2 or DDR3 memory, is going to be the speed. Generally, once again, RAM that's rated faster than what your system currently will take should be backward compatible. But once again, you're only going to ever get the speed out of it that your system's rated for. So if you buy a 133 megahertz DDR3 module and put it in a system that only supports 1066 megahertz, it's going to run at 1066 megahertz. So you're not going to get better performance, but you can buy faster rated RAM and put it in a slower rated slot. Not a problem at all. Again, in general, I'm speaking in general terms. Sometimes Macs are a little bit picky about the kind of RAM that they have, so I usually try and also make sure that I'm buying from sources that I've had experience with in the past and know that their RAM works. And also I check the comments and do a little research online before I buy a module to make sure, yes, it's going to work with my system, and yes, it's going to give me the performance that I want. So often when I have these conversations about RAM, someone will ask me, what kind of brands do you buy? For the most part, in all my Macs, I've always stuck with two different brands, either Kingston or Crucial Memory, and more these days, I just buy directly from Crucial because their site makes it so easy to make sure you get the right stuff through that little selector. And I've never had an issue, knock on wood, never had an issue with Crucial Memory. So Crucial.com, MacSales.com is a great place to go to get components, both hard drives and memory. They sell all kinds of different brands. You can look on their website. They have great prices, and it's easy to order. You could go to your local big box store, so Best Buy or Fry's, one of those, and you'll find a lot of these same brands. There you might find more off brands, so I tend to be a little bit picky about what I find at those places, or also Amazon or Newegg. And I noticed that Amazon does carry Crucial Memory, so does Fry's, as a matter of fact. But just find your local reseller, and again, check reviews and just ask people. See what they're saying. But that's what I do when I'm doing upgrades. And then as far as actual installation, like how do you get this stuff in your Mac? Well, if you have a Mac Pro, it's pretty easy because you don't necessarily need special tools. But sometimes you will need special tools. Specifically, little small Phillips screwdrivers, number 00 or 000, these little tiny screws that are in these things, or maybe little tiny Torx screws, like a T6, you'll hear thrown around. So you might want to pick up a computer toolkit, and you probably want to go check for your specific model what kinds of tools you need. A great source for that is iFixit.com. They have awesome step-by-step directions for replacing, upgrading, swapping out components in Macs and iOS devices and stuff like that. I was actually able to use their instructions to repair my iPhone 3GS on my own. And that is a great resource. Common question when you're doing these kinds of upgrades is, will it void my AppleCare warranty? So my machine's under AppleCare. Do I have to go to Apple and have them install my RAM or install a new hard drive? The short answer is no. I've asked a lot of people about this. I've gone back and forth with Apple, and essentially what they come back to is they will not cover any components that aren't spec'd from Apple. So if you put a new hard drive in there, they're not going to cover your hard drive under AppleCare. If you put different RAM in there and something goes wrong with your RAM modules, Apple's obviously not going to replace those under AppleCare. But that doesn't void the warranty for your entire system. Anything that was stock with the system is still going to be covered. The other thing is, if you do any damage to the system while you're doing your upgrade. So if you get a static shock in there and you fry the motherboard and it happened when you were putting in RAM modules, they are not going to cover that because that was damage that you caused. But, you know, that makes sense with or without doing, you know, DIY upgrades. Needless to say, because of that, things can happen when you're doing upgrades. Make sure that you have a backup before you do any upgrades. And also, if you're going to be getting in there and messing with the internal components, use a grounding strap. It's like $5 to order one online. Use a grounding strap just to make sure you don't have any stray static charge buildup or anything shocking and frying out components on your Mac. You're in there working with stuff, so it's cheap and easy, and a lot of people skip that step. And, you know, 90% of the time, nothing goes wrong without it, but that 10% of the time, that's going to be the time that it's going to really bother you. So that's installation. So, and then what do you do with the old components that you take out? So if you take out an old hard drive, maybe you're replacing a 500 gigabyte hard drive for a 1 terabyte drive, you can reuse that. You know, you might want to consider picking up a little external enclosure from OWC and popping that drive in there, and now you have an external drive that you could use for backup or for additional storage. If you have old memory modules, you might consider handing those down to somebody with an older system. Make sure they check the compatibility first, because, you know, not all RAM works in all models, obviously, but as long as it will work in a system, why not just hand it off and give it away? So someone who might only have maybe 2 gigs of RAM can upgrade to your 4 gigs because you jumped up to 8. So those are just a few thoughts and ideas on upgrading. Obviously, there's other components you can upgrade, graphic cards and things like that, but those are probably the two most common that many of us are going to want to do. And then, I guess, related to this earlier topic about sort of upgrading, there was a question from Jeremy. He has a new Retina MacBook and was curious about the airport card in there because he was doing some shopping for routers and noticed that a lot of the new routers support this new 802.11 AC standard, and the new Retina MacBook Pro, which is just released and some people are just getting their new models, it has 802.11n. So he was asking, you know, is there going to be a firmware update? If you remember, there was a model notebook, I can't remember which one, that came out that had 802.11g card in it, and then Apple later revealed, oh, we've got a software update, it's actually got an N card in there, we just need to turn it on and enable it. And he was curious, is it possible that the Retina MacBook Pro has that? And I did a little digging into it. I don't think it does. They use a Broadcom BCM 4331 chip, and according to its specs, it's got that 3x3, you know, so it can do 3 simultaneous streams. It's nice and fast, but I don't think it has the AC technology built into that chipset, so it's not something they can just go flip a bit. And it looks like from the iFixit teardown that it's possible you might be able to swap out the card at some point, because it is on a little daughter card, slides into a slot. But, you know, getting in there to replace it might be a little bit tricky, and you're going to have to wait for some aftermarket company, some third-party company to make an 802.11 AC airport card for the MacBook Pro, the Retina MacBook Pro. But it's possible, although highly unlikely. You might be looking at upgrading your Mac before you get that support. And I guess as we're talking about upgrading hardware, it seems appropriate to talk a little bit about software upgrades. And we've got Mountain Lion coming out, but what about, you know, just the software on your operating system and the Mac App Store and things like that? Nathan sent me an email pointing out something a bit curious, and I'm trying to get an answer on. Unfortunately, I don't have a machine where I can really test this, so I'm going to turn to you, and hopefully someone knows how this works. But he was saying, you know, I bought iPhoto on the Mac App Store. I have a Mac that runs Snow Leopard and cannot run Lion. And the recent updates to iPhoto, 9.3 and 9.3.1, are Lion-only updates, and that's now what's sold and available on the Mac App Store. And I confirmed that. I do have a Snow Leopard machine, but I didn't buy iPhoto through the Mac App Store, so I tried to see what would happen if I just tried to purchase it, and it tells me my system's not supported, and it doesn't run under Snow Leopard. So the last version of iPhoto that ran on Snow Leopard was 9.2.3. And so Nathan's concern, and I think this is a good one, is what happens when I need to rebuild my system? So I do an erase and install of Snow Leopard. I go back to put my software on, which should re-download through the Mac App Store. Is it going to download the correct version for my machine? Or is it going to tell me my machine's not supported and now I'm out, you know, the $15 that I paid for iPhoto? And another thing somewhat related to this is, you know, Apple dropping support for iCloud in Snow Leopard. You add that into the mix, and it seems like Apple is clearly trying to force people to upgrade based on software. So I really hope this isn't the case, and I'm really feeling like what would happen for Nathan is that you would reinstall the operating system, it would go to the Mac App Store, and the Mac App Store would be smart enough to say, you know what, you need 9.2 on here, you bought iPhoto, here's 9.2, and it would just reinstall that version. But it means also that people aren't getting bug fixes. You know, somebody pointed out to me that he can't upgrade to 9.3 because he's running Snow Leopard, and so he's not getting all the latest bug fixes and updates and that sort of stuff. So that goes back to this concept with iCloud and my complaints about, you know, that not being supported. That is Apple really trying to force people to buy new hardware just to be able to get new software? If they are doing that, that's something that I am not at all happy about, especially considering the fact that I know a lot of people that have Macs that are 4, 5, 6 years old that are very usable, serviceable Macs. And I guess, you know, I've made the argument in the past too that the old software doesn't break, and I still believe that sentiment, you know, that you can still use the old version of iPhoto, but if there's bug fixes and stuff in there, Apple should at least be pushing out those bug fixes for all users. You know, and we're not talking about new features and functionality, a brand new upgraded version, but just updates like they've done with the operating systems. You know, when the operating system comes out, they do still continue to push out security patches and fixes, stuff like that. I hope that sort of thing doesn't stop. But the last thing I want to just leave with is there anyone out there who's running Snow Leopard, who's had to do a clean install, who bought iPhoto through the App Store? What happened? Did it reinstall? Did it tell you didn't have a compatible version? Did you have to go back to Apple and try and get them to give you a version that'll install on your system? I really don't know what would happen. So if you can confirm my suspicions that it'll just be smart and install the right thing, which I'm really hoping for, that would be great. You can send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Okay, we got a ton of stuff to still get to, and we've got that really technical thing that I was telling you about that I wanted to dive into. So we're going to go deep. Get ready here. We've discussed on the show in the past how to use parental controls to control access. So if you have kids and you want to block them from getting to certain applications or certain websites and things like that, OS X has great built-in parental controls. We've also talked a little bit about using OpenDNS, which allows you to block things at the DNS level. But I got an email from Andrew who had kind of a more specific need related to YouTube video access. And so he's already got parental controls in place to block YouTube, you know, because there's stuff on there that many of us probably don't want kids to see. But occasionally, he wants them to be able to access the Khan Academy videos, which are these great educational videos, and they're hosted on YouTube. So what he has to do now is he has to, every time his kids want to watch one of these, enter in his admin information and basically unlock the system, allow them to watch it, and it comes up over and over again. Luckily, he discovered that YouTube has this really cool thing called YouTube Schools. It's designed for if you're a school and you want to give YouTube access in the classroom, you can do that. But seems like anybody can sign up. I was able to sign up as a quote-unquote school and just have this functionality added to my account. The educational videos are actually available to everybody without even doing this. You can go to YouTube/schools and watch any of the videos that's there, but it's kind of this segregated content. But for someone who is a school and wants to only have access to that version of YouTube, they give you the ability to do that, and there's instructions on the website. But basically what they do is they control access to that by having you modify the request headers that are sent to YouTube.com, add a little bit of extra information, and then that makes sure that you only get the school version of the YouTube site. And you do this through setting up a proxy server. So that's very commonly something an educational institution or a company will have set up, where all of your traffic internally on your network goes through this one server, and then that server handles the requests in and out of the internet, and it can do things like filtering and monitoring and stuff like that. So you need to be able to modify this request header, and so the question was, how can I do that in Mac OS X? And I had a little bit of a hard time finding a solution for this. Probably the easiest one that I found is there is a Firefox add-on called Modify Headers. And you would have to be using the Firefox browser, but you can add in this add-on, and then through some simple settings, you can adjust the little request header that Mac would send out through Firefox and give to YouTube and add this additional bit of information. That would require, of course, that you force your kids on their computer to use Firefox, but that probably wouldn't be too tricky. The other downside to this solution is that it would be very easy for your kids to just go into the Firefox settings and disable or remove the plugin and get around the restriction. So while it's easy to set up and use, it's probably not the best solution. More robust solution would be to set up an actual HTTP proxy server and require the kids' Mac to go through that proxy server. On the proxy, then, you'd have full control to be able to monitor and log and do routing and block traffic and do all sorts of things. Might even be a better solution than just using the built-in privacy controls, because, once again, those are on the Mac, and a smart kid might be able to figure out how to get in and hack around those. If you have a whole separate proxy server set up on your network and require their machine to go through that proxy server, you could do a little bit more control and blocking, as well as gain access to the ability to do this YouTube Schools thing. So I thought, you know, OS X probably has some sort of proxy server built into it that you could just enable, but I really couldn't find one, and I couldn't find any instructions or information for it online. I thought maybe even Mac OS X server has it, and it probably does, but it didn't seem like it was a simple thing to set up. The one thing I did find as I was searching was there is a proxy server called Squid. It's an open source proxy server, and it is generally installed and configured from the command line, which isn't very user-friendly. But there was an application, a GUI application, that'll help you install and set up Squid. Now, the one added disadvantage of Squid is apparently it cannot by itself change the request headers. So it might be, not be able to do exactly what you want, Andrew. It can change request headers if it's coupled with something else called an Internet Content Adaption Protocol server, an ICAP server. And there's an open source one called Greasy Spoon that works in conjunction with Squid and would probably give you the functionality that you want. Unfortunately, the GUI tool that I found, which is called Squidman, seems to only set up and configure the Squid proxy server. And I was able to use that on my Mac, the Squidman software, and that was pretty easy to quickly get it up and running the Squid proxy server. But for that, it's only going to do kind of caching and just allow you to increase your network performance. But I'm throwing it out there because some of you I know have asked about, you know, bandwidth. You can save on some bandwidth by setting up a proxy server and directing your traffic through it, especially if it's a proxy server like Squid that allows you to do local caching. So basically all the websites that you would visit would get cached locally on the server and get served up directly over your local area network if none of the content changed on the internet. If it changes on the internet, it'll pull down a new copy through the proxy and serve that up. So that's kind of how this stuff works. So Squidman is great for configuring and setting that up. And you can enable that to run on a server on your home network and then route other traffic through that. And the other thing that some proxy servers will do that Squid doesn't do is provide anonymous browsing. Sometimes people want to kind of hide their IP and hide their information from browsing. It does not do that, at least not out of the box with some tweaking. So all that said, because of the requirement to have an ICAP server to do what you want, Andrew, I don't think the whole Squid solution is going to be your best solution. So I continue to do some additional digging and found what I think is the ultimate solution. There is another option. There's an application called Glimmer Blocker. And this is actually originally designed as an ad blocker. And it installs in your system preferences. It runs in the background. And it is a proxy server. Basically, once you've turned it on, all of your Safari traffic then proxies through the Glimmer Blocker. And then the Glimmer Blocker has filters built into it for all the different ad servers and basically blocks the ad at the proxy side. And then what it delivers and serves up to you, to Safari, has all of the ads stripped out. So you don't see those when you're in Safari and they're blocked. But the good news is that you can add a custom filter, and those filters use JavaScript to do their magic. So there's actually a JavaScript method that's built into the Glimmer Blocker software that will allow you to change the request headers. So you can put a little simple bit of JavaScript in there, build this custom request header, send that to YouTube, and achieve what you want. And what's great is Glimmer Blocker also allows you to, from its network tab, enable the proxy service. And then basically you have a proxy server set up on one Mac, and you can point your other Macs at that and then filter the traffic through there. So you don't have to just filter the local traffic. You can actually choose not to filter the local traffic, say, on your Mac, set up Glimmer Blocker on your Mac, and then point your kids' computer to go through your Mac as the proxy server. And you'll be able to control other things, like filter out other content, block ads, and stuff like that. And if it's running on the same Mac, so if you want to put it on your kid's Mac, it actually has the little lock icon and would require admin access to set up and configure. So you could lock it down that way. But I would really recommend, if you're going to set this up, actually setting up your proxy server on a whole different Mac on the network that only you control. And that'll keep the kids out. So hopefully that works for you. If anybody else knows of another proxy server that you can use with the Mac that's easy to set up and configure and can specifically change request headers, please let me know about it, because I had a really hard time finding that. Now, after this is all said and done, the ultimate goal of this was to allow his kids to watch the Khan Academy videos through YouTube. Another solution, if you have an iPad, and probably the easiest one, or any kind of iOS device, is the Khan Academy has a great free app that lets you access all of their content in all of their videos. So it would be outside of YouTube. It'd be restricted to just the app, and you'd have just access to that content. And all you have to do is download the free app and install it on your iOS device. So that's probably the route I would go, rather than trying to set up all these proxy servers and stuff like that. But I did play around with Glimmer Blocker and was able to get it set up on my home network and working with the YouTube school site just fine. If you need more specific details, email me and I can maybe share the instructions. Maybe I'll even do a how-to video, because it was pretty cool and it was pretty amazing, this Glimmer Blocker software, what it could actually do. So stay tuned for that, and thanks, Andrew, for the question. And I don't know, was that nerdy and technical enough? I mean, proxy servers? Wow. How many of us need that? And I know a lot of us don't need that, but, you know, these topics come up, and just by sharing those ideas and concepts and stuff like that, that might give you an idea of a way you could use a proxy server in some other application. So it'll start this conversation, and at least, if nothing else, if you didn't know what a proxy server was before, you probably know a little bit more about them. So we're always learning here on the MacCast, and I think that's one of the things I always try and do. It's part of this community, this sharing of thoughts and ideas, and this stuff just comes up. I mean, we had a need, and hopefully we have some sort of solution, and I'm sure some of you are going to recommend some way better solution that I didn't come across, and that's really what I'm hoping for. All right, Scott has a problem with his Apple TV 3. I guess he's one of those guys that bought one of those, 1.3 million Apple TV 3s. He's using home sharing with his Apple TV to access movies that are loaded on his Mac running iTunes, which is a great way to get your content over your television, and something a lot of us want to do. But the trouble for Scott is that he says at least once a day, it will lose that connectivity to the home share. And the fix is easy. Luckily, he just needs to go back into iTunes, go into the preferences, and then into the sharing tab, and doesn't have to do anything else other than click OK to kind of reset things. And then it'll start working again until the next day, and then the whole process starts all over. So very annoying. He pointed me to a long thread on the Apple discussion boards of a lot of people reporting this issue. I've personally had issues like that as well with home sharing. For me, the culprit almost always was the energy saver and the system going to sleep. Even though I have the wake for network access option turned on, I would find that when the Mac would go to sleep, iTunes would suddenly go away, and then my other devices on my home sharing network could not connect to iTunes till I went back and woke up my Mac. So what I did is I went into System Preferences, into the Energy Saver, and then set the computer to never go to sleep. Slid that slider all the way over to the right, said never. You can go ahead and leave Display Sleep on. It's just the computer sleep that you need to turn off. And once I did that, my problems kind of went away. And because how you described it, Scott, you said you just had to go into iTunes and basically click OK, but you really didn't change any settings or even have to restart iTunes. I'm wondering if just the process of going back to your Mac and waking it up kind of was what enabled you to get access back. Another thing that I would check would be your network router. You might check and make sure that your firmware is up to date. Maybe there's a little incompatibility going on there. There were also some posts that I noticed about IPv6, Internet Protocol Version 6, which was added in a recent OS 10 update, better support for that. And I think it might be turned on now by default because we're moving to IPv6. But some reports say that disabling that can actually help with some of these network home sharing connectivity issues. So if you want to disable IPv6, because a lot of us aren't using it yet, you can go into the Apple menu under System Preferences and then click on Network. And then if your network preference is locked, you're going to have to click the lock and enter your admin username and password. But once you've done that, you can choose the network service, either your airport or your Ethernet, and then click Advanced, and then click TCP/IP. And then in the pop-up menu, you're going to click Configure IPv, which is typically set to automatically. You want to set that to off, and that will disable it. And it's possible that might fix your issues. So you're going to do this on the Mac that is running iTunes. Turn off IPv6 and see if that helps. Other than that, you may have to wait for a fix from Apple. In the meantime, you know, Scott was saying it's a real hassle because I've got to go wake up iTunes and my Mac is all the way upstairs away from the living room. That's kind of a hassle. The way I've gotten around that is to use screen sharing in VNC and have remote control of my Mac from my iOS device, either an iPhone or an iPad. So sitting in my living room, I can go wake up my iTunes and reset it and stuff like that without having to leave the comfort of my couch. So if you want to do that, you go into System Preferences under Sharing. You check the screen sharing on, turn that option on, and then in the computer settings, click the little computer settings button, a panel will slide down, and you'll check the box that says VNC users may control the screen with a password. And you want to set a password, make sure you set a secure one, and then you can use an app like ISSH or iTeleport, and you can connect directly to your Mac and control the screen. You could also use a third-party application. If you don't want to do the whole VNC setup, you could use something like LogMeIn Ignition, which I think is $15 on the Mac App Store. I bought that. And that, you just run a little client on your Mac, you run the software on your iOS device, and the two just see each other. They connect. It's almost like zero configuration VNC. You don't have to get in and do the whole technical stuff. But either of those solutions should work. And then that way you won't have to leave the couch to get things working again. So I hope that that helps you out. Now I have an iPhoto question. This one came from Bill, and he found some interesting files, or rather his boss found some interesting files on his computer, and he had a question about
it. Hi, Adam. My name is Bill, a longtime listener. Love the podcast. You do great by the community, and just wanted to say that up front. I have a friend who's also my boss who called me with a question today, did a little bit of, you know, Google search on the online, Apple forums and stuff, didn't get a really consistent answer to this question. And the question is, he was doing in Finder a search, and he's not on Lion. I think he's on Snow Leopard. But at any rate, he saw a listing of, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of IPMETA files related to using iPhoto. And he called me because of my experience with Macs, and he said, can I delete these files? There's just tons of them. I think they're taking up space on my computer. And I said, well, first of all, don't delete them. I said, I'm not really familiar with what you're looking at, so let me do some research, which I've done. And I even have searched your site. I don't see any discussion forums about IP meta files. I know they're metadata files, small metadata files related to iPhoto files. But he wants to know if he can delete them. I've seen some posts that says, yeah, it's okay to delete them. I've seen others say, no, don't do that. You'll corrupt your iPhoto library. So I thought I'd turn to you and your community and see if you guys could help. Just kind of clarify what they are, how they're used, and if they can be deleted, just so I can get him an answer and also know the answer myself. So appreciate your help and look forward to your response. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, Bill. Thank you. Yeah, happy to help out. You know, this is what the community is all about, but I have a feeling I did a lot of what you did. I knew about these files, but didn't know a lot about them. So my research came up with similarly mysterious results. And I think one reason why is that, you know, iPhoto no longer uses those files, at least the most recent version, iPhoto 11, as near as I can tell. They seem to have been files that were around in iPhoto 08 and in 09. I don't know how far back they go. But you know, now they're contained within the iPhoto library, which is a package file. So I find it a bit odd that he would find them coming up in a spotlight search. Again, unless they were, you know, back in the days when iPhoto just had a folder that had all this stuff in it, maybe he's on that old of a version that he has the folder that he can actually go in and search in. But, you know, if you want to see where these files are, if people are curious where they are, I found out they can exist in two different places. One is in your home folder, in the library folder. there might be a folder called iPhoto Library, and then inside that, there might be one called Metadata Backup, or they could be in your home folder, in your pictures folder, and then in the iPhoto Library, again, either folder, or more likely, that's going to be the iPhoto Library package, and you'll need to do the whole control click or right click on that file and choose show package contents. And then once in there, there might be a folder called metadata backup. And if you look in there, you might see these .ip meta files. And there will typically be a couple different ones for things like the schema, the keywords, the albums. They all have these associated metadata files. And I was able to go in and actually poke around in an old copy of iPhoto 09. And it turns out these files actually look like they're really just plist files or XML, technically XML files, just with a different extension applied to them. So I was able to copy one of them off and change its extension to .plist and then open it up. And it looked just like, you know, a property list file that you might see for an application's preferences. Something like that. So they're really just simple text files. You think you already mentioned they're really small. They shouldn't be taking up too much space. There's a lot of them. So I guess in aggregate, they could take up a lot of space depending upon the size of your iPhoto library. But really, you know, you're talking about 4K, a couple K files. And they do seem to have some equivalence in the latest version of iPhoto, iPhoto 11. But in this case, they're now in the home folder, inside pictures, inside that iPhoto library package file, inside a folder called database, and they have a different extension. They're now called things like .apdb and .apalbum and .apfacename for the faces functionality and .apdetectedfacenames or file names. But essentially the same kind of files, and they're just like these XML files. They don't have any actual picture or photo data. I saw some confusion online. Some people were thinking they found these files and they could use them to recover, you know, lost photos. They don't have any photo data in there, but they do store information related to your albums, your images, the organizations of those, the schema related to them, keywords, organization, and all kinds of other related information about how stuff is cataloged and organized inside iPhoto. So they are pretty critical files. The general consensus seemed to be that you could delete the files, but then iPhoto would simply just recreate them the next time it launched, although I couldn't find any information from an official source to confirm that. I assume, you know, like certain data, like the faces information, if you deleted these files, even if they were recreated, that stuff's going to be completely lost. So you'd have to rebuild that and reassign it. And if you've, you know, added like lots of faces or additional metadata information, that could be a lot of work and a big pain. So my gut feeling is I wouldn't necessarily want to delete these files. I think you may also be able to rebuild them or rebuild that data by holding down the command and option keys while you're launching iPhoto. That gives you some additional maintenance information or maintenance options that you can perform when you're launching iPhoto. And in there is an option that says rebuild the iPhoto library database from the automatic backup. Now, normally you'd only need to do this if you were having problems with iPhoto and it was crashing at launch or not loading photos at all. And no matter what you do before performing any of these things, I would recommend that you have a full backup of your iPhoto library, of course. But you could try running that to rebuild them, you know, but I'm not really sure. I just leave them, in his case, I just leave them in place. You really don't want to go messing around in the iPhoto library, and especially not in the new iPhoto library package file, because you could really break something, you could mess it up, which I think is what you probably found out when people were saying, don't delete these files, you could corrupt your whole iPhoto library. So either way, I think bottom line is you shouldn't need to or want to delete those IP metadata files. If your boss is having issues with those, he might consider moving his iPhoto library, the actual photos themselves, which are probably taking up a whole bunch more space, might consider moving those off onto an external drive if he needs more space on his internal drive. And in that case, you just go into the preferences and, you know, repoint iPhoto at the library file that's off in another location. So get them off the drive to save space. But I wouldn't purge them or delete them. So I hope that helps you out. If anybody has additional information about these files and just iPhoto in general and saving space, let us know. And, you know, the way I save space is I get rid of old photos. I put them off into an archive. I save out a different library file and move that to a backup. And that's how I get space back. So you might consider giving him that bit of advice as well. And I guess sticking on the topic of iPhoto, Michael was having an odd issue that popped up with iPhoto and his photo stream, but on just one of his Macs. So his other Macs and devices were able to connect to PhotoStream just fine, but he was saying this one Mac just kept giving him an error message. The error message was that iPhoto cannot connect to PhotoStream every time he wanted to turn on and activate the service. And so he tried a number of different things. He tried logging out of iCloud from the system preferences and restarting his Mac. He tried logging into iCloud from system preferences and turning PhotoStream back on, opening iPhoto and enabling PhotoStream from the preference pane, but kept getting this error over and over. Luckily, he was able to ultimately resolve the issue, and he shared the information with us just in case one of you run into this exact same problem. So the way he finally resolved it was by going in, deleting iPhoto. Again, make sure you have backups. That's going to be a running theme for me. Always have backups before you do anything that I tell you to do on the MacCast. This probably should just be the blanket warning. So make sure you have a backup, but then go in. You can delete iPhoto and then delete the iLife plist files. And then he went in and disabled PhotoStream from all of his devices and his Apple TV, turned it off. Then he went and he signed out of iCloud on the Mac, rebooted the Mac, downloaded and reinstalled the latest version of iPhoto, I'm assuming from the App Store. You could also do it from your original disks. If you do it from your original disks, make sure that you run the updates so you get up to the latest version of iPhoto. Then he signed back into iCloud on the Mac, opened up iPhoto, enabled PhotoStream, and this time it worked. It was able to connect to PhotoStream, did not give the error message. And then he went back and just re-enabled PhotoStream on all of his devices and on his Apple TV and was good to go. So that worked for Michael. If you've been having this issue, you can try those steps. It's a little bit convoluted and, there's a lot of steps in there. You had to do a lot, but if it gets you back up and running with PhotoStream, it might be worth it. And then the last thing that I have for you today, we talked about the new Retina MacBook Pro. There's a bunch of you that have ordered them. I know a lot of people are still waiting for them because they're back ordered. Gorgeous machine, very popular. Apple's selling a ton of them. But I had a little concerning thing happen this week because I got a couple emails from a few of you that, hey, I got my new Retina MacBook Pro, but there's a couple people who mentioned that when they arrived, they were actually damaged out of the box, which, if you're buying that gorgeous new machine and spending the kind of cash on it that you're going to have to spend, that would be incredibly frustrating. And because of the constrained supplies, it's not like you can just take it into the Apple Store and have them swap it out. Well, maybe you can, but chances are they're going to be back ordered and not have them in stock and not be able to give you a new machine. But in one case, one was a scratch, and the person who told me about it did say, it was very minor, almost unnoticeable, kind of on the edge of the case. I think it was actually a nick and a scratch. The other person sent me some photos, and it was a horrible dent, a pretty big divot on the top lid. His box actually came, the shipping box actually came, and you could tell it had been tossed around. So I have a feeling that the UPS guy or FedEx guy or whoever was not taking great care with it, or it somehow got damaged in transit. I guess we shouldn't blame those guys, but something happened to it and it had this big gnarly dent. I guess the outer box that they ship it in is, it doesn't provide a ton of protection. And then, of course, the inner box, especially the top lid, is pretty flexible. It doesn't have a lot of strength to it. So anything that would come down hard on the top of the shipping container could potentially dent that machine. Maybe Apple needs to give some consideration to, you know, beefing up the packaging a little bit. I know they've been trying to be environmentally conscious with how they ship stuff and ship them in the smallest possible boxes, but it sounds like in this case it might not be working out. And what I'm curious about is this a rampant problem with these models? Is there anyone else who has a little bit of damage on their machine? I hope the answer is no. I hope everybody's getting gorgeous, pristine MacBook Pros, and these are just a couple of random edge cases. But because I got two in the same week, I'm getting a little bit nervous. So email me, let me know, maccast@gmail.com. And with that, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment, thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get a free trial. More information over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, the latest version, also all of their other great software. You can get more information and details on everything that they make, as well as free trials, over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, if you need to get cash, if you want to buy a new laptop and you want to get some cash maybe for that old one and don't want to have to deal with the hassles of auction sites or, you know, doing classifieds, check out Gazelle. You can get an offer and more information and details on the service over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. I know this episode's getting a little bit long, but I do have one more little item of housekeeping, and it's because I've been getting a number of emails from people who've been reporting that Apple's new podcast app seems to have some trouble with the MacCast, specifically streaming or downloading directly in the app. And I know a couple of people have had even some problems with Downcast and Instacast and some of the other third-party applications. For whatever reason, I cannot seem to replicate these issues, so it's really intermittent, or I can't figure out specifically what is causing the issue, but basically you get an error message saying that you can't connect or you can't download the episode. I don't think I'm having server issues. I've checked with the service provider. Bandwidth is actually provided by CacheFly, which is a great service, and we thank them for providing that bandwidth. But it's a very reliable service. It doesn't really go down, so I don't think that's the issue. What I can say is I've had this issue intermittently on and off with Apple, with the music app, with direct downloads, and it's incredibly frustrating to me. I know it's frustrating to you when you encounter it. All I can say is I've brought the issue up to Apple. They said they've looked into it in the past. I haven't had a resolution. And the reason I'm saying it's Apple's fault or problem or issue is because the same exact servers, the same exact RSS file, the same exact audio files that you download through iTunes, if you download them through iTunes, they download fine. Sync them over to your device. They play fine. It's exactly the same application that's playing the file. So it really seems to be some sort of connectivity server problem on Apple's side. I think it's something related to the Mac App Store. And the other common thing I'll hear people tell me is, well, everybody else's podcast downloads fine. It's just your podcast. So the other factor that plays into this is I do the enhanced AAC version. So you get the chapter markers, you get the changing album art, you get the links, all that good stuff. And people have told me they don't want me to get rid of that. That's what's available in iTunes. And it seems to be only AAC podcasts that have this problem. If I send someone the direct MP3 feed link and they plug it into the application, the MP3s download fine. And that's what most other podcasts deliver, which is why you don't notice the problem on other podcasts. So I just wanted to point all of that out because I'm getting a lot of emails related to this, and maybe that'll save me a few emails to explain it. Please give some feedback to Apple. Go to apple.com/feedback. Let them know you're having issues. Send them screenshots. I've contacted them. Hopefully we'll find some sort of resolution for this. It's some weird edge case because, again, I'm not having a problem on my devices. I'm able to connect just fine, and I know that doesn't help you if you're having the problem. So I'm not saying that for that reason. I'm just saying to point out that I'm having a hard time troubleshooting it because I can't find a consistency to say, oh, it's this, and this is the thing that we need to fix. And I think Apple's having a similar style problem. So just hang in there. The ultimate workaround is just download through iTunes and sync over iTunes the old school way. I know a lot of people want to stream. I don't know if it's related to 3G. It seems to have popped up in the 5.1.1 update to iOS. It doesn't seem to be fixed in iOS 6, or at least as near as I can tell. It's made worse by the podcast app from Apple. So all of these things coming into play. If you have any insights or you found a different workaround, be sure to share it with us, maccast@gmail.com. And that's going to do it for this episode. Sorry for spending so much time on that, but I really wanted to get that information out. All right. If you have any other feedback for me, any comments, any questions, you can send your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast. If you'd like to get show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/themaccast. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.